All right, welcome to the worship service of the Atlanta Church of Christ, Gwinnett. It's great to be here this morning. We're having this is our third class in a series on the Book of Numbers, and this was their wilderness out there in the picture of the. I guess we're going to have a reboot, but we have a wilderness too. And it's a different-looking wilderness, but it's a wilderness just the same. And the Book of Numbers is going to teach us some things about what our life in the wilderness is that we can learn from what their life was like. And we had some unfinished business from last week, and so we're going to invest some time this morning in talking about last week's class. And I will summarize last week's class very briefly, because we are going to get through the first four chapters of the Book of Numbers today and do the unfinished business from last week. So, we talked about last week we asked the question, who are these people that we read about in this story of life in the wilderness in the Book of Numbers? This Israelite nation that came out of 150 years of slavery. That's right, turn on. Here we go. And there's our wilderness, and there's their journey. We covered last week, we talked about Genesis 47, how Jacob's family and 12 sons came to Egypt and lived in the land of Goshen. That was prophesied they would be there for 400 years. About 150 to 200 years of that, they were in what we would call slavery. We would consider it slavery. Most objective people would. Forced labor, lack of civil rights, lack of freedom, lack of ability to have control over your own destiny. And they were led out of Egypt by Moses, a Levite from the tribe of Levi. We'll talk about that. In Exodus 12, talks about their exodus from Egypt. They crossed the Red Sea. We all know that. Many of us, we should know that story, how they crossed through the Red Sea. God had led them by a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire, and then they wandered along the coast of the Red Sea here on the Sinai Peninsula, the Desert of Sinai, they called it. We talked about in Exodus 15. They started to complain. We also know that when Moses first came to them back in Exodus 9, they were a little, there was definitely pockets of skepticism about them being rescued. And finally, they got to Mount Sinai, where Moses found the Ten Commandments, which was going to be their law that was going to define their nation. And so we picked up, one of the unfinished business from last week was we looked at the background of these people, how they got from. As we talked about, Exodus was a journey from something, from slavery. They were delivered from that. Numbers is going to be a journey too. So to start that off, I wanted to have my lovely assistant come up, and we're going to do that's right. Justin, I want to get some comments from you guys. After about 150 years of slavery, and these people now are in this community together, we estimate somewhere between 2 and 3 million people traveling nomadically in this community, just having been delivered from slavery, from bondage. I wanted to do a brief look, brief comments from everybody, strengths of this community. What would strengths of this community be? What would weaknesses of this community be? What would opportunities for this community be? And what would threats to this community be? So let's talk about strengths. Danny.
The sheer number of people.
Okay, so sheer number. Allison.
Well, they all lived in the same area when they were in Egypt, so they are probably the families knew each other, and they were probably involved in each other's lives.
Okay, so there's already probably a sense of community they had. Okay, Alex.
Perseverance.
Okay, that's a good one. Mary. Okay, God and Moses. James.
Skills.
Skills, okay. That's a good one. Okay, let's talk about weaknesses. What weaknesses do you think they would have coming out of this? Danny. Okay, Robin.
I think not strong enough faith.
Okay. We read about that some of them, you know, were sort of like, I'm along for the ride. I don't know that I'm bought in yet, especially when they were bitten and delivered. Dan.
Being slaves, not sure how much leadership there would have been among
their
number other than the head guys.
Okay, the weakness may have been that they didn't really have a culture of leadership or governance. They probably hit, you know, Bill. Okay. Is that a weakness?
A lack of it,
maybe. Tracy.
No financial empowerment.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. It was only what they could carry out with them at that time. They were going into a desert. Dorsey.
No home base.
Okay. No home base. Allison. Okay, yeah, they were still having, they still hadn't arrived to where they were promised they were going to go to. Glenn.
Probably a lack of resources
also. Okay. Okay. Thank you, Carol.
Bitterness.
Okay. They're bringing sort of a experience of generations. Maybe some of them never actually had the ability to go out and live with a different type of responsibility. Okay, let's talk about opportunities. What opportunities would you say this community has? Todd.
So completely by faith, because they couldn't see anything by sight that would military protection or resources or whatever.
Okay. So to walk completely by faith. Anybody else want to throw anything? Natasha. Okay, and we're going to see that. They probably outnumbered their, people, potential adversaries. Peter.
They had developed a lot of the skills that actually enabled Egypt with those same skills, artisan skills, building skills, for a trade-off.
Okay. Alan.
They had the promises of Abraham.
Okay. So you already had this faith promise that God was going to work with them. Alex. They have complete control of their destiny now. How about threats? What do you see as threats to this community? Peter.
I think one of the biggest is complacency. They had gotten used to being the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of taking the risks was a very scary thing for them to show up a few times.
Okay, complacency. That's John. Okay, if there wasn't unity in where they were going, and we, you know, probably see that in the. Anybody, Mary?
The dangers of the wilderness itself, like starvation, animals that might threaten
them. Okay, the nature of being out there. I'm sorry, what, Kathy? Okay, yeah, Steve. Okay. Okay. Cool. Okay. Tracy. Okay. Okay. It's like a power struggles would be a threat. Allison. Okay. Good stuff. Yeah. Distrust of who God had appointed to be a leader. Thank you guys for that. That was some great input. And what we're going to do is I'm going to take this, and in the concluding class, we're going to come back and look at some of these and see how it played out. So that was the point of that. Jessica's got them written down. Thank you, Jessica, for doing that. And now, and thank you for your input on that. But yeah, I had a few things that I had mentioned. They had a sense of shared suffering. That can bring unity and identity to a group. They had, I would hope, the strength would be gratitude for newfound freedom. God, and some have said that God had chosen them. A couple of weaknesses I'd put down was they had an upheaval to their existing social structure. That happens whenever you have change, and that can be tough. And then their responsibility was going to take new forms for their life. So I just wanted to. Okay, so here we are. If you have your Bibles, turn to Numbers chapter 1. Can I use the Bible? Sorry. I was going to use my phone today for the but I want to use the today. I found it to be I used the hard copy, the first class, and I used the electronic copy the second class, and I liked the hard copy better. So Numbers chapter 1, and the title of this class is. We're going to have a series of classes, and they're all titled the same thing, and it's Preparation to Enter the Promised Land, First Generation. This is the generation that came out, and so this class, and then Steve Marithi is going to come in the next two classes, and he's going to teach what we would call parts two and parts three of a section that's going to cover about the first 12 chapters of Numbers. And if you think about it, if you were in that group, you're coming out of slavery. The story here picks up on the second month of the second year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. You know, what you're thinking is, what's next? What now? And so God, as we read the story, God is preparing them to enter the promised land. He's preparing them. And I think as we study these next couple classes, I want you to always keep in mind that chapters 13, 14 haven't happened yet. We know they happened, but you know, think about the fact they didn't happen yet. And here they are getting ready to go. So let's pick up and we'll read in verse 1 through this passage and talk about it. The Lord said to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai on the first day of the second month of the second year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. He said, "Take a census of the whole Israelite community by their clans and families, listing every man by name, one by one. You and Aaron are to count, according to their divisions, all the men in Israel who are 20 years old or more and are able to serve in the army. One man from each tribe, each of them the head of his family, is to help you. These are the names of the men who are to assist you. From Reuben, Elizur, son of Shedeur. From Simeon, Shelumiel, son of Zurashaddai. From Judah, Nashon, son of Amminadab. From Issachar, Nethanel, son of Zuar. From Zebulun, Eliab, son of Helon. From the sons of Joseph, from Ephraim, Elishama, son of Ammihud. From Manasseh, Gamaliel, son of Pedazur. From Benjamin, Abidan, son of Gideoni. From Dan, Ahiziar, son of Amishaddai. From Asher, Pegiel, son of Ochran. From Gad, Eliasaph, son of Duel. From Naphtali, Ahira, son of Enan. These were the men appointed from the community, the leaders of their ancestral tribes. They were the heads of the clans of Israel. Moses and Aaron took these men whose names had been specified, and they called the whole community together on the first day of the second month. The people registered their ancestry by their clans and families, and the men 20 years old or more were listed by name one by one, as the Lord commanded Moses. And so he counted them in the desert of Sinai. And then it goes through, and it summarizes each of the 12 tribes, not including the Levites. We'll talk about that in a minute. And he summarizes how many there were, and we'll pick up in verse 46. The total number was 603,550. The ancestral tribe of the Levites, however, was not counted along with the others. So we'll talk about that in a minute. So, I think what's interesting, or the first thing I wanted to make note of that really hit me when I looked at this was, the Lord is the one who spoke to Moses. And if you read it, the Lord is the one who actually picked the names out directly. It wasn't like, Moses, you go find them. You go figure it out. The Lord, and what that tells me, I think, is significant, is the Lord knows every, sometimes we lose track of this, but the Lord knows every individual in that 3 million people or 2 million people. He knew every individual, and he was the one who actually called out each of these people by name to lead. I think it's pretty cool. He knows us the same way, in that fashion. But what we're looking at here is they had about, again, 600,000 men over the age of 20 who were able to fight. So there probably were some men that weren't able to. There's obviously a lot of people under the age of 20. There also, as it says, as we talked about last week as well, there were people that weren't Israelites that came along with them on the journey. And that's something that, may not be a big part of, it may be a factor in what we look at later, but, that implies that there's a big number of people out here, a large number of people, and God was taking care of them. This census was oriented toward this census was commemorated by God. God authorized Moses to take this census. Sometimes people say, well, David did a census of the fighting men. He counted the fighting men back in his time, and he got in big trouble for it. Big difference is God authorized this one. David, God didn't authorize, David to do his. Big difference. And so, and we'll see there's also a purpose behind it. They're preparing for war. They're preparing to take hold of what God was promising them. This was a significant part of it. You could say, and we're going to turn now to Numbers chapter 2. The other thing, the 20 years old, is you could look at it as this could be interpreted. Some people say this is a basis for some to say that the age of accountability in adulthood is 20 years old. Interesting, just a thought. We've kind of defined it as being 18 at the end of our secondary education. We give kids a primary education to eighth grade, and then we give them what we call a secondary education, and usually by the age of 18, we're ready to turn them loose. Maybe they, maybe that 20 years old is significant in that sense. There was a significance to maybe the age of 20 is that, that's how God looks at the age of accountability, possibly. Let's turn to chapter 2, reading verse 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, look at this little picture here. Here we go. And let me go back a minute. As you can see, that to me is a cool picture because it kind of gives you an idea of the magnitude. I think they did a good job on this of giving you kind of a magnitude of what the army and the community would have looked like. And you can see there's a lot of very organized and orderly. So here's a picture that will supplement what we're going to read about here. So we're going to pick up in chapter 2, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, the Israelites are to camp around the tent of meeting, some distance from it, each of them under their standard and holding the banners of their family. And so what we'll do is the rest of the chapter goes into great detail about where they camped at. And so, this is kind of a good image. Picture's worth a thousand words. This is, I think, a very good image of chapter 2. It describes, this is sort of a graphic image of what they described, how they camped. And it's very directional. They start with, the eastward facing, and the eastern side of the camp was considered the front. That was considered, that was the way they were going to march. So you can see here, Judah, Zebulun, Issachar. There's actually some hereditary connection here, or pattern, if you notice. You notice that Rachel's sons, Joseph, right, Ephraim and Manasseh, and Benjamin were kind of together. You can see here, Leah, and you can see I go back and look at the 12 tribes. just as a reminder of everybody. But there's actually some hereditary connection in how they were together. Simeon and Reuben are the two oldest, and Gad was a son of Leah's handmaiden. So that's kind of connected together hereditary-wise. There's another image. Judah was had the honor of being the leading tribe going to the front, and they kind of he's kind of prophetic as to how they ended up leading the Israelite kingdom and when the kings were established in many ways. Zebulun and Issachar were also Leah, and then Dan and Asher I think were Rachel's handmaiden sons, and I think Naphtali was Leah's handmaiden. So there's a little bit of but there's some pattern here, you know, with hereditary relationship. I think was probably made some connection there. So this was how they camped. The picture of the great organized camp and orderly march of Israel is interesting, but it presents a contrast to the disorganized, disorderly condition of human society in every land and every age. I mean, I think, you know, they've set this up so no matter, you know, as we know, the cloud comes down, and when and we'll look at this in Steve will look at this problem in his section when he gets there, Numbers chapter 9, but they go into detail talking about the cloud. So it comes down and covers them, and they live under this cloud. And whenever the cloud rose, that was their sign that it was time to move. So you can see there's some orderliness here. There wasn't going to be a controversy every time they camped, every time they came in. You know, this is it keeps us organized and it keeps us without bias. There would be no arguing or confusion about where to camp when the cloud stopped. Think about it. Think about, you have 3 million people, and you move, you know, maybe we're going to march for about 10 miles today on a journey, and we're going to camp. Everyone knows where to go. That's pretty cool, to be organized. And that's what he was giving them. We have organized and programmed elements of our ministry, don't we? We have the children's ministry. We have teen ministry. We're organized in family groups. You know, we can be based, you know, we're organized kind of based on geography. We're based on stages of life. We're based on different needs. There's an organization. Organization's a good thing. It's good to have a consistency about what we're doing so we can know what we're going. You know, we all like to change things up every now and then, but at the same time, we have the Israelites, God was giving them a foundation of being organized. Okay, let's turn to Numbers chapter 3. As they prepare. And Numbers chapter 3, and here's another rendition of what it may have looked like too. You know, the first one had the pattern, you know, where they were sort of camped out. And again, this middle section we're going to talk about in Numbers chapter 3 is the Levites. And then we've got, you know, the camps. The east is down on the page, north is to the right, west and south. So, you know, they stayed in this fashion, and this was the tabernacle and the courtyard, and that was probably a pretty large in itself. If you scale it off, it was probably pretty large. A lot of components to it. So I think, you know, it's just to give an idea of what it might look like. And this rendition kind of somebody interpreted that maybe, you know, they had them lumped, you know, tiered away from each other. You know, it's just a possibility. Okay, so now we're in Numbers chapter 3, and we're going to read starting in verse 1. This is the account of the family of Aaron and Moses at the time the Lord spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai. The names of the sons of Aaron were Nadab the firstborn and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. Those were the names of Aaron's sons, the anointed priests who were ordained to serve as priests. Nadab and Abihu, however, died before the Lord when they made an offering with unauthorized fire before him in the desert of Sinai. They had no sons, so Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests during the lifetime of their father Aaron. The Lord said to Moses, "Bring the tribe of Levi and present them to Aaron the priest to assist him. They are to perform duties for him and for the whole community at the tent of meeting by doing the work of the tabernacle. They are to take care of all the furnishings of the tent of meeting, fulfilling the obligations of the Israelites by doing the work of the tabernacle. Give the Levites to Aaron and his sons. They are the Israelites who are going to be holy, given holy to him. Appoint Aaron and his sons to serve as priests. Anyone else who approaches the sanctuary is to be put to death. The Lord also said to Moses, I have taken the Levites from among the Israelites in place of the first male offspring of every Israelite woman. The Levites are mine, for all the firstborn are mine. When I struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, I set apart for myself every firstborn in Israel, whether human or animal. They are to be mine. I am the Lord. So, go back. So, the section in the middle here, these are the Levites. This is where they camped. They camped inside. The rest of the tribes centered around the center. And the Levites had the took on the special duty of taking care of the tabernacle and the worshiping of God and the priesthood in general. Nadab and Abihu, they died when they made an offering with unauthorized fire. Again, you know, something unauthorized has consequences. This episode is alluded to as a warning five times in Numbers and Leviticus. This is the first time, you know, it's mentioned. They don't actually tell it as a narrative story. Probably happened sometime in the Exodus first couple, you know, the first right at the outset. But they don't really, you know, they allude to it in the past tense in all these places. But it's alluded to quite significantly. Let's see. So, they go through and do it, and they take a census in the rest of the chapter 3. They take a census. They say, count the Levite. God said, count the Levites by their families and clans. Count every male a month old or more. So Moses counted them as he was commanded by the word of the Lord. And so it summarizes that. They go through and talk about there's three sons. Kohath, Gershon, and Merari were the three sons of Levi that became sort of within the tribe of Levi, these sub-clans, I guess you'd call them. And so in verse 39, it summarizes that the count came up with that every male a month old or more, there were 22,000 Levites. That were 22,000 male Levites a month old or more. And then they counted, this is interesting, verse 40, count all the firstborn Israelite males who are a month old or more and make a list of their names. So now he counted all the Levite men, males. Now he's going to count all the firstborn males of all the rest of the, tribes. And the number came out at 22,273. That's almost it's almost like a one-for-one match. Kind of interesting. And so there was almost, and so for the 273 unreckoned, they made a 5 shekel contribution per firstborn male as a tribute to the Lord. So this was like the first establishment of the first payment, if you would, of honoring this commemoration that God wanted them to have. And that was to honor God's claim that the firstborn of Israel were his. What I was going to say about the firstborn is that this was a decision that God made, and so this represented something to the Israelites. This represented, God intended this, the Levites, to remind them of the Passover. That's what the Levites and the Levitical priesthood was there to do. One of the elements of the covenant with God was this Levitical priesthood represented, when you thought of it, you're supposed to think of the Passover. And be reminded that the other 12 tribes had their firstborn sons, they did not have to give them to Lord's service. The Levites were going to do that on their behalf. So there was a lot of significance to this. And I want to point out there were two places. Let's see. Get to my notes here. Yep. So there are two places in the Old Testament that you can think of. And there may have been more examples. If there were, you can let me know after. But this, what was this, the sin of Jeroboam? In 1 Kings 12:31, when Jeroboam, God gave him the ten tribes after Solomon's son Rehoboam. They rebelled against Solomon's son Rehoboam, and they established the ten tribes, all except Judah and Benjamin. Jeroboam, it says, Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. An element, and this, if you remember that, you know, you always go back and read the sins of Jeroboam. That this was an element of the sins of Jeroboam. They dishonored the Passover by disobeying this instruction. He just started appointing priests, you know, from all the tribes. He didn't rely on the Levites to be the priests. And God took great offense to that. It was something that God, you know, the God's word and the writers led by the Holy Spirit talked about that was a major offense to God and was a major sin of the northern kingdom. They never were able to restore. They never restored that back as long as they existed. And then, of course, if you know, 2 Chronicles 26 is the story of King Uzziah. If you remember King Uzziah, he was, for all intents and purposes, he was considered to be a good to great king. He had a, you know, he did a lot of good things. It said that he followed the Lord. You know, he did, but he had one episode where he went into the altar and he wanted to serve and do priestly tasks. He got, you know, and the priests were all like, he was the king of Judah. You know, so he was, you know, they were still honoring the Levitical priesthood in Judah, whereas the northern kingdom had already forsook it. And he came in and they were like, don't do this, don't do this. You know, and he was over there, it says he was raging. I want to do this. I'm the most powerful, you know, his pride. I can do anything now. God has made me so successful. He wants me to do this, you know. And he found out pretty quickly when he turned leprous that he couldn't. You know, so there's a lot of significance. This is the source of, when you read these stories, you sometimes wonder, why is that such a big deal to God? Well, you can see here, he's saying, I want you guys to remember, there's principles that God teaches us in what we do. You know, I think, you know, baptism, you know, taking communion, remembering Jesus. You know, the ordinances that we have in the church, they're there for a purpose. They teach us things. They're not just things, you know, God will be okay if we don't do it. Got to be okay if we don't teach the meaning behind it correctly. It's important. So, we're going to pick up in Numbers chapter 4. And basically, Numbers, and we're not going to read out of the text, but Numbers chapter 4 goes through the three subclans of the Levites, the Kohathites, Gershonites, and Merarites, under the three sons of Levi. And each of them had responsibility for this altar, this worship of God that they were establishing. Again, you see organized order to things. God setting up a pattern for them to follow. The Kohathites were in charge of the holy things. The Gershonites were in charge of the curtains of the tabernacle and altar. You know, it must have been a lot of curtains, you know. The Merarites were responsible for the frames and the surrounding courtyard. And yet, and again, on a 3 million a scale of 3 million people you're ministering to, you know, there's a lot of work to do. And again, they were going to disperse into these communities and serve these roles. The tribes were not authorized to serve in these priestly roles, just the tribe of Levi. Again, God giving them a structure that may not seem like make sense to us. But as we, you know, but the point is, God's saying, trust me. There's a reason for it. I'm building a culture. And that's part of, you know, what it means. So really, today's class was to look at take a first step to get an organization and order. That's what we see in these first four chapters. Without the divine law, there is no progress. Divine rallying point There is no unity without it. Faith must control. The standard of Christianity must show the way. Otherwise, the nations will only wander aimlessly and fight and die in the desert. You know, there's an orderliness to our faith. There's organization to our faith. There's cooperation. There's desire to build unity. I mean, the apostles' teachings give us a lot of passages on that. You know, Ephesians talks about the different offices that we have in the church. Pastors, elders, evangelists, prophets, teachers. There are different responsibilities. You know, 1 Corinthians 14, Paul talks to the Corinth church, says, God is not a God of disorder, but of peace. So it's interesting. What does he contrast peace with? Disorder. He doesn't contrast peace with, you know, we think about war, peace and war. Well, he actually says, no, peace and disorder. Peace and anarchy. Peace and, you know, just everyone doing their own thing. Craziness. That's interesting, isn't it? So I want to stop there with our class. I'm going to say a closing prayer, and then after that, we're going to be dismissed.